Truth Seekers, I hope you had a good holiday season so far. I hope you're going to survive New Year's Eve. A friend died New Year's Eve, Lynn Samuels. I think a lot of you already are aware of this. I got a Christmas Eve, I'm sorry. I got a spate of emails today from folks who were familiar with her program and felt, as I did, that they knew Lynn. Kathy and I met Lynn a couple of times in New York when we were there doing business with, at the time, Sirius. This was before they merged with XM. And after meeting Lynn the first time, Kathy and I talked about how, wow, is she real? And she was. And got to be the kind of friends that you get to be in this business, which means you don't see each other very often, unless you work for a sewer like Fox. But didn't get to see Lynn very often. I know she mentioned me a couple of times on the air. I mentioned her a couple of times in the air. She was truly an entertainer and died way too young from early reports. The cause of death was not immediately announced. I don't know if they know. She died alone. There's no family or to speak of. No next of kin, I should say. She used to do a Christmas Eve show that was different from the program that she did other times of the year. She would invite her listeners to call in and sing Christmas carols. And John Minnelli, her WABC program director and longtime Fred, is quoted in the Daily News as saying, quote, "She was unique beyond words. I'm so glad I knew her." And I feel the same way, even though I didn't know her that well. But I knew her well enough to get together and raise hell about these stinking right-wingers. She was one of the those activists from the 60s, and her radio career began around 79 or 80. She had a late-night show on WBAI in New York, and she was fired three times from WABC, rehired twice, and at times she struggled to keep living in the city. I think she lived in Queens. At one time, she took a job in a laundromat while she was working at Sirius just to make ends meet. So, Lynn Samuels has passed at the age of 69. So, moving from the real and the sublime to the insane and the ridiculous, I guess you have heard about the riots around the country in Indianapolis, Charlotte, North Carolina, San Antonio, Texas, Houston, Texas, Detroit. Minor riots at malls. Have you heard about that? Yeah, it's about the release of the Nike Air Jordan Concord shoe. Tennis shoe. Sneaker. Taylor, Michigan is the location of Southland Mall, and police were called in for assistance at 5:30 in the morning, right before Christmas. There was a large crowd of about 300 people lined up outside. The mall was not scheduled to open until 8 a.m. Police report about 100 people gained entry to the mall through two doors near JCPenney and Best Buy, and the crowd forced their way into the mall by pulling the main doors open, damaged some of the decorations and benches that were toppled over during the scuffle. Black and white sneakers, which cost about $180, there had been reports that thousands of people were lining up nationwide at various retail outlets for these goddamn shoes. I mean, this is sick. I mean, to me, see, I think people that would do this are really in need of some kind of sedation or something. Sneakers. You stupid bastards. I mean, is it that important to you, a pair of goddamn shoes? I mean, Michael Jordan sneakers! Woohoo! One guy walked in one of these malls with a gun and fired it, I guess to make everybody drop so he could grab a pair. This really, really is a sick-ass country, you know? This is just one example of it. But this is no different from the example of some wealthy pissant spending $40 million for an apartment in Midtown Manhattan. It's the same thing. Same thing. Lining up for a $180 pair of sneakers that you are, you know, willing to riot for and maybe fire a weapon in order to get one is no different from the pigs that spend $20 million on an apartment. You know what I'm saying? It's a kind of materialism that is so toxic and so ugly and so unbelievable, so vile and so American. Of course, we've exported it now. I don't know. So you ever get that feel you don't know whether to laugh or cry, right? You look at your fellow human beings, and after a story like that, after seeing video or hearing or reading about people rioting in malls in order to get their hands on sneakers, you know, you could guess a lot of things about the people who would do that for a pair of Air Jordans, couldn't you? You could guess about their education level. You could guess about their economic level. Do they have $500 in the bank? Do they eat a decent breakfast? Are they concerned about global climate change? Or are they just want to line up for a pair of goddamn sneakers? I just can't get my head around the story. I read it and I see some of the video and I think, well, but this can't be. This can't be. First of all, the obscenity of $180 for a pair of goddamn gym shoes? What? This program is not getting off to a congenial start this evening. So let us take a break here. And let me see if I can have another SIVA call and come back and talk straight.
So long. where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, baby, I'm on the dark side of the road. But I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. But don't think twice, it's all right.
Program. From Susan in Squim, Mike, I felt the way you did until about the sneakers, until I found out that it was even worse, and that there was only a limited number of these sneakers made. In anticipation, they were pre-selling on eBay for $400. Some of the people in those lines were desperate. Out-of-work people trying to make a little money. So that makes it even more sad in my view. Horrible all around. Making a limited amount of them was Nike's way of creating this mess and a bad economy and double-screwing everyone. Wow, I didn't know that. So you create the buzz, right? And then... Oh, well. You may have seen reports of this over the weekend. On Saturday, tens of thousands of people in Russia converged in midtown Moscow for the second huge anti-government demonstration in a month. You see that picture on the front page of the Times? The electronic version or the print version. Did you see that? Lord. Estimates are anywhere from 120 to 150,000 people, which, okay, that's not a huge number, but when you think about how difficult it is to get even 10,000 people into the streets here, plus the fact that, as my understanding from reading the article or a couple of articles, that the weather was just rotten, icy cold. I mean, the kind of Moscow cold that you and I would say, oh, my God. Hours later, after speeches and bloggers and poets and people got up to talk, and a couple of politicians, kind of like Occupy movement in this country. But several hours later, as the protesters started to leave, the reports say they were chanting slowly, "We will come again. We will come again." Ooh, Mr. Putin. Now, what's this all about? A couple of things, most of which is political in this particular demonstration. Although there is a rising tide of frustration and anger in the Soviet Union, or I'm sorry, in Russia for matters other than just political. But the parliamentary elections that were held last month, or this month, I guess earlier in December, it was pure fraud. I would not be surprised if Karl Rove had not gone to Moscow and showed them how to lie, cheat, and steal. Putin is the type of leader that the power structure in this country would like to see get another six-year term, or eight-year, whatever the hell it is. Why not? He's an oligarch. He's the worst type of capitalist. He's the type of capitalist who got fat, so to speak, from eating the corpse of socialism. And he's a terrible, terrible man, kind of like Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney and Putin are disaster capitalists of the highest order. They're thieves, liars, and zombies. The protesters have some demands. The dismissal of the head of the Central Election Commission. The dissolution of Parliament and new elections. And changes in the election code to allow for free competition. That sounds quaint, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound quaint? Whereas over here, the vermin that are the Republicans are doing everything they possibly can, and they're being very successful at it. I guess Eric Holder is going to try to do something about it, in keeping people from the polls. In Republican-controlled Bantustan, after Republican-controlled Bantustan, laws are being passed that say you have to have X, Y, and Z in order to vote, strictly in violation of the Constitution, the Voting Rights Act anyway, for sure, but probably a violation of the Constitution, too. But the Republicans know that they are hated and eventually they will be smashed under the heel of history. They know this. So they're trying anything they can to stay in power. And in Russia, about the same thing. But the Russians are saying, well, I'll tell you what they said in just a minute. Let me do this break and we'll come back. Maybe we should start saying this too. Stay with us.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's Mike Malloy.
With the pure white fire. Oh my God. Sneakers. Sneakers. I don't know. What are you supposed to do with that, huh? Oh, well. So, the Ruskies taken to the streets in the tens of thousands because they don't like the way their elections are being stolen. And they have demands. The dismissal of the head of the Central Election Commission. God, that sounds so Soviet, doesn't it? Central Election Commission. Vladimir Churov is his name. The dissolution of Parliament and new elections and changes in the election code to allow for free competition. See, if we took to the streets here, the first thing would be the utter and absolute destruction, as a second choice, of every single electronic voting machine in America. The first choice would be dismantle them, put them in a warehouse someplace, and return to paper ballots. And then I wonder how much toxic material exists inside those voting machines. The The protesters, according to one observer, seem to be saying something to this effect. Respected leaders, many of us have come here for the first time, fully consciously and entirely independently. We have something to lose, and we are for stability. But the violation of your own rules, and this is the way we take the information about mass falsifications and violations of statistical patterns, violation of your own rules, this is too much. They're talking about the voting. This is too much. So, all the demonstrators interviewed said they were hoping to avoid a violent uprising. But some left the possibility hanging in the air like a warning. Alexei Navalny, the blogger whose enormous popularity set these protests in motion, addressed the crowd. He was greeted with a deafening roar. Navalny, who is 35, who listened to the first protest earlier this month while he was serving a 15-day jail sentence, he listened to it on the radio. He said at the second protest on Saturday, quote, "I can see that there are enough people here to seize the Kremlin. We are a peaceful force and will not do it now. But if these crooks and thieves try to go on cheating us, if they continue telling lies and stealing from us, we will take what belongs to us with our own hands." End quote. Well, well, well. Seems like the Occupy movement, in all its different incarnations and forms, is spreading. Villagers in China, not many, but a few, are starting to revolt because the workers are not sharing in the improved lifestyle that the Communist Party leaders, all duly elected by the villagers, seem to be enjoying. Change to come to China, though, is probably simply not going to happen, at least not in our lifetimes. Ah, that is good coffee. From Prairie 2, and I think he wrote this in response to something I said last week. He said, "It's inappropriate to characterize the unconscionable behavior of Republicans as simply racism toward the president, or even as lowball politics. They don't really care if Obama is black, white, or green, and of course they like being in power, but the billionaires who pay the lobbyists spend even more money on them when they are on the out. Their goals are more basic and well-reasoned. Republicans do nothing that isn't planned out for them. The other day it appeared that House Republicans had really stepped in it by rejecting the bill signed off on by nearly all of the Senate Republicans. But the talking points were all ready and everyone had them memorized, including all the corporate news writers. All of a sudden it was the Senate Democrats who were abusing not only the jobless by making them live month to month, but the Democrats are abusing the job creators as well with all this, you know, uncertainty. It seems the job creators need to know just exactly how desperate the potential serfs are going to be in the coming year before they can do anything. It's incredible that a six-figure salary will so easily get people to commit treason. What Republicans are about might not be technically called treason, but it is certainly insurrection, or to use a phrase from the Red Scare era, quote, conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States, end quote. Republicans would say they are the government and represent the people. Capturing the government by fraud doesn't make you the legitimate government of the people, neither here nor in Russia. They do the opposite of what they are saying at every turn to the benefit of a handful of billionaires. These people are bent on making the 99% into serfs and ending democracy forever, and they call themselves patriots. Real patriots spilled their blood to rid us of these same people. The Tea Party, Ron Paul, and the Libertarians appeal to the people who grew up in the 30 years since Ron Reagan and his cult ended education and history, civics, and critical thinking in general. These young people know something is wrong, but they don't really know what. They have been more or less educated with an entirely made-up version of history and taught a kind of economics that simply doesn't work. They think that America was built by rugged individuals, when the reality is that nothing was ever done that way. They believe the myths of Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, while the real men with those names depended on the cooperation of all the people around them. Nobody has ever made it on their own. But libertarians are sure if all the rules were done away with, then they can reach their full potential. People will flock to them, shower them with money, gold only, please, and finally accept the wisdom they have been delivering from the stool at the end of the bar. They just don't grasp their real enemy. And they don't grasp that their real enemy has been robbing them of their potential, their wealth, and their heritage as an American. Their real enemy is capitalism. They don't get that capitalism is not the opposite of socialism. Capitalism is just a form of totalitarianism based on economic fraud. If a foreign enemy landed in their town, burned every business district for 40 miles in every direction, and forced them to work at starvation wages, they would be calling for revolution. Walmart does this with every store they open. But the libertarians like the low prices and will shop there faithfully, even if it costs them everything. From Prairie 2. That was from last week. I just didn't get around to it. You can visit his website, prairienumeral2.com. And also, where is that thing? I got something. I got something from Michael in Roswell, New Mexico, about, I had asked a question about, the China syndrome, the nuclear disaster that is occurring in, and I think Prairie 2 wrote about it also, that is occurring in Fukushima, Japan. Michael wrote me an explanation of what that's all about, and I may share it with you a little bit later in the program. Just looking through what we have here tonight. Newt Gingrich is terrified that Islamic law is going to take over the country. And then something that a Russian research team has discovered bubbling to the surface of the Arctic Ocean. We'll be right back. But I found out I'm just a link in your chain. Oh, you got me while you want me. I'm nothing but a fool. Treat me mean. Oh, you treat me cruel.
then you're not paying attention. Back to Mike Malone.
It's about 9 before the hour. Yeah, the, methane is a greenhouse gas that science tells us is 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide insofar as it destroys the atmosphere and brings about global climate change. Scientists, Russian scientists, and Americans also are undertaking an extensive survey of the Arctic Ocean, where it concerns methane bubbling to the surface. And according to the Independent of the UK, the scale and volume of the methane release has astonished the head of the Russian research team, who's been surveying the seabed of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf off northern Russia for about the past 20 years. In an interview with the Independent, he said that he has never before witnessed the scale and force of the methane being released from beneath the Arctic seabed. He is the with the Russian Academy of Sciences. And he said, quote, earlier we found torch-like structures like this, but they were only tens of meters in diameter. This is the first time that we've found continuous, powerful, and impressive seeping structures, more than 1,000 meters in diameter. It's amazing, he said. I was most impressed by the sheer scale and high density of the plumes. Over a relatively small area, we found more than 100 of these, but over a wider area, there should be thousands of them. End quote. Now, scientists estimate that there are hundreds of millions of tons of methane gas locked away beneath the Arctic permafrost, which extends from the mainland, in this case Russia, into the seabed of the relatively shallow sea of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. And one of the greatest fears of scientists, not Republicans, will tell you this is all nonsense, but one of the greatest fears is that with the disappearance of the Arctic sea ice in summer and rapidly rising temperatures across the entire region, which are already melting the Siberian permafrost, the trapped methane could be suddenly released into the atmosphere, which would lead to rapid and severe climate change. Now, a right-winger would read this and either fall asleep or go to the bathroom or something, but the answer would be, well, that's not man-made. No, you half-witted morons, it isn't. But what's causing the permafrost to melt, what's causing the ice shelf to dissolve, is man-made. And as a result, this is that tipping point thing that scientists have been talking about. The man leading this, Igor Semilitov of the Far Eastern branch of the Russian Academy of Sciences. His team, Dr. Semilitov's team, published a study last year estimating that the methane emissions from this region were about 8 million tons a year. But this latest expedition suggests this is a significant underestimate of the phenomenon. Pow! In late summer, the Russian research vessel, academician Lavrentiev, conducted an extensive survey of about 10,000 square miles of sea off the East Siberian coast. Scientists deployed four highly sensitive instruments, both seismic and acoustic, to monitor the fountains or plumes of methane bubbles rising to the sea surface from beneath the seabed. Dr. Semilitov said, quote, in a very small area, less than 10,000 square miles, we have counted more than 100 fountains or torch-like structures bubbling through the water column and injecting directly into the atmosphere from the seabed. We carried out checks at about 115 stationary points and discovered methane fields of a fantastic scale, I think on a scale not seen before. Some plumes were a kilometer or more wide, and the emissions went directly into the atmosphere. The concentration was 100 times higher than normal. Dr. Samilatov released his findings for the first time a couple of weeks ago at the American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco. Getting scared yet? Oh, we don't want to hear that! God damn it, all that negative talk. Jeez! I don't know. When we come back after this break, I want to share something with you that Paul Krugman wrote. And over the break, we are going to open the phone lines. So if you'd like to join in, feel free to do so. 877-996-2556 is the number here. And going back to the first thing we talked about, late reports now say that Lynn Samuels died of a heart attack. Okay, we'll be back momentarily. Stay with us. Finding all these monster plumes of methane bubbling up from the floor of the Russian Arctic, if you will, in this country, we had a regulation put in place over the I guess it was last week. In the form of new EPA standards on mercury and air poison coming from power plants. Krugman wrote about this on, was it today? The rules are finally here. We were supposed to start regulating mercury more than 20 years ago. That's how long it's taken just to... This is why we're all doomed. You know we're doomed. So, you know, I guess what we should do is just, for our sanity, our collective sanity, just pretend that we're not doomed. Those of us who have small children, this is going to be kind of a mind rape. But 20 years to put into place rules on mercury... And we have what happened in Japan back in the, was it the 50s, 60s, when mercury was released by Japanese industry and got into the seafood chain. And surely you saw those pictures. A lot of them appeared in the old Life magazine of children who were suffering from mercury toxicity, either before they were born or after they were born. Horrible stuff. But so we've been working on this, or somebody's been working on this for 20 years. By working on it, that doesn't mean they've been studiously and diligently trying to write the regulations. It means the regulations have been ready to go, but capitalist America kept saying no. The capitalists don't want this because they would have to spend some money to clean up their filthy, death-belching power plants. We can't have any of that. Oh, my God, no. Anyway, the rules are finally here. And Krugman says, we'll deliver huge benefits at only modest cost. So naturally, Republicans are furious. Of course. Of course they are. Republicans are murderers. Every single one of them. They want to kill you, your parents, your grandparents, your children, your grandchildren. They want to kill everything. But anyway, let's take a look at what the EPA just did. Mercury is really hideous stuff. It's a potent neurotoxin, a neurotoxicant. And you've heard that expression, mad as a hatter. It emerged in the 19th century because hat makers at the time tested, treated fur with mercury compounds and went nuts, suffered nerve and mental damage as a result. Just go back and read Alice in Wonderland. A lot of mercury gets into the atmosphere from old coal-burning power plants that just don't have modern pollution controls. The technology is available. This is the part that makes me want to go violent. The technology's available. The technology's there. It's simply a matter of putting it on. Oops, excuse me. I didn't mean to yell. Anyway, the mercury gets into the atmosphere, and then it gets into the water, where microbes turn it into methylmercury, which builds up in fish. And what happens then? This is what the EPA says. Quote, methylmercury exposure is a particular concern for women of childbearing age, unborn babies, and young children. Well, come on, you right-wingers that like to stick your nose into the private space between a doctor and the doctor's patient when it's about issues of, you know, woman stuff. Here's your chance. Anyway, it's a particular concern for women of childbearing age, unborn babies, and young children because studies have linked high levels of methylmercury to damage to the developing nervous system, which can impair a child's ability to think and to learn. Well, all the more reason to not put the scrubbers on the smokestacks. We don't want them learning. We don't want them thinking. Oh, my God. Anyway, this all sounds like something we should regulate, right? Methylmercury? As Krugman says, new rules would also have the effect of reducing fine particle pollution, which is a known source of many health problems from asthma to heart attacks. In fact, the benefits of reduced fine particle pollution account for most of the quantifiable gains from the new rules. The key word here is quantifiable. EPA's cost-benefit analysis only considers one benefit of mercury regulation, the reduced loss in future wages for children whose IQs are damaged by eating fish caught by freshwater anglers. There are, without doubt, other benefits to cutting mercury emissions. But gosh darn it, at this point, the EPA doesn't know how to put a dollar figure on it. So who's going to pay any attention, right? Even so, Krugman says the payoff to the new rules is huge, up to $90 billion a year in benefits compared with around $10 billion a year of costs in the form of slightly higher electricity prices. It's a deal, of course, Republicans very much want to kill because they want to kill people. Oh, they'll never pick up a gun. They're good at picking up nooses, but they'll never pick up a gun. They'll never confront somebody straight on. They just want to kill the regulations without which people die. Krugman says, with everything else that's been going on in U.S. politics recently, the Republicans' radical anti-environmental turn hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. But something remarkable has happened on this front. Only a few years ago, it seemed possible to be both a Republican in good standing and a serious environmentalist. During the 2008 campaign, John McCain warned of the dangers of global warming and proposed a cap-and-trade system for carbon emissions, which is more hogwash. Cap and trade? Cap and trade. Well, you're not polluting, but I am. So I'll tell you what. I'll trade some of my pollution to you because you're at a 3 and you can go to a 9. Capitalist dirty tricks. Sorry, Mr. Krugman. Cap and trade to me is a filthy, filthy scam. But I digress. I digress. Today, the party line, the Republican Party line, is that we must not only avoid any new environmental regulations, but we must roll back the protections we already have. Why, hell yes. Quicker death. Quicker destruction. But why? I don't understand this. Krugman says that, I'm not exaggerating, during the fight over the debt ceiling, Republicans tried to attach riders that, as Time magazine put it, would essentially have blocked the EPA and the Interior Department from doing their jobs. Remember? We talked about that. Remember last week? Remember that? Last month. Oh, whatever. Whenever you hear dire predictions about the effects of pollution regulation, you know, who was it? John Huntsman the other day. Him, you know, the one I've been going, but John Huntsman. He denounced the EPA's what he calls regulatory reign of terror. And he predicted that the new rules will cause blackouts by next summer, which would be a neat trick considering the rules don't even go into effect by next summer. But that's all right. He's a Republican. At bottom, he's a filthy Republican, just like the rest of the filthy Republicans. A little bit more on this when we come back. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
Toe to toe, touch and go, give a cheer, get your souvenir. People running around in circles, don't know what they're headed for. Everybody's crying peace on earth just as soon as we win this war.
Everywhere. I do not like them on my station. I do not like them in my nation. It's more Mike Malloy.
Yeah, it is. 21 past the hour. So, closing off this particularly depressing topic, as Krugman says, whenever you hear these dire predictions from Republicans that if you regulate something, it'll destroy everything. And if you try to regulate pollution, it'll cause companies to go bankrupt. You should know that special interests always make such predictions, and they're always wrong. Always. For example, power companies claim that rules restricting the effect that would cause acid rain would disrupt electricity and lead to soaring gas electric rates. None of that happened. And the acid rain program became a clear example of how environmentalism and economic growth can go hand in hand. But this is reality-based, and Republicans are not reality-based. They are death-based. And, you know, in their minds, death is just another step to Jesus or something. I don't know. But again, never mind. Mindless opposition, as Krugman calls it, to job-killing regulations is now part of what it means to be a Republican. And Krugman says, I have to admit this puts somewhat of a damper on my mood. The EPA has just done a very good thing, but if a Republican, any Republican, wins next year's election, he or she will surely try to undo this good work. Still, for now at least, those who care about the health of their fellow citizens, and especially of the nation's children, they have something to celebrate. But the Republicans will destroy that as quickly as they can. You know, last week we had sponsorships, I think, for three nights from the anti-mountaintop destroying organization in West Virginia, Coal River Mountain.org. I hope you went to crm.org and checked it out. But isn't it interesting that people who are trying to save themselves and us, their children and mine and yours, their nieces and nephews and grandparents, the people who are trying to do this through common sense, science-based rules and regulations about how far we can go in continuing to destroy our home, that those people are always outmanned, outgunned, outspent, and that the Republicans will do anything to lie about all of this. They even try to set the meme, and sometimes they do a pretty good job of it. Job killing! Job killing. Job killing regulations. Putting restrictions on the amount of mercury that can be dumped into the atmosphere to a Republican, you filthy bastards, is job killing. Not child killing, which, if the regulations aren't put in place, is exactly what will happen. No. Republicans like to dig their greasy fingers into the private space between a woman and her physician and tell the woman and the physician under penalty of assassination not to touch the zygote. But living, breathing children and men and women and teenagers and young people and old people and good people and bad people and delinquents and drug addicts and homeless and in other words, everybody who breathes. No. No job killing regulations. No. We are Republicans. We are filthy, disease infested whores. And our pimps in capitalist America, tell us how to handle you. No offense to clean, neat, sensible sex workers. No offense. I'm talking here about Republicans. And so it just continues. Until such time, if it ever comes, that Americans, and not just Americans, but you know, Russians and Brits and Canadians and Mexicans and Bolivians, Chinese, Indians, Persians, Arabs. Zimbabweans, Egyptians, Cameroons, South Africans. You know, when people come to realize how destructive the capitalist system is and what to do about it.
I'm free.
You're now entering a flying monkey free zone. It's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. The mercury poisoning that I was mentioning, Michael and Roswell and Tim in L.A. have given me some more direct info. It's referred to, the proper name is Minamata disease, sometimes referred to as Chiso Minamata disease, a neurological syndrome caused by severe mercury poisoning. And I believe wasn't Minamata where this occurred, where it first occurred? It attacks the muscle system, the nervous system, vision, hearing, speech. Results in insanity, paralysis, coma, and death, followed within weeks of the onset of symptoms. And a congenital form of the disease can also affect fetuses in the womb. And this is what the coal industry and the power generating industry, the electric companies, like, oh, let me think of one. General Electric. Do they still generate electricity? This is what they are willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to stop any form of regulation on this poison. You just got to wonder why, don't you? I mean, I do. And Bruce writes, most electricity is generated by the burning of coal. Half of that electricity is lost in long transmission lines. Half of the coal would not need to be burned if we had community generation instead of getting it from huge utilities. Half of the electricity being consumed could be produced by capturing the wasted heat from industry. Coal company lobbyists and the utility shills keep this from happening by simply banning the practice. How do they have a right to do that? Basically, Bruce writes, the consumption of coal to generate electricity is unnecessary, but it makes billionaires a lot of, well, billions. Don't hold your breath for this to stop. Or maybe you should. Yay, yay, yay. Tim is in Decatur, Alabama. Hi, Tim.
Good evening, Mike. Happy holidays to you and Molly and Kathy.
Thank you very much.
Hope
back
you're
at
having
you.
Having a good time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Between the joys of people trying to kill each other over shoes, which is a crazy form of capitalism to me, I never have understood the logic behind. We're only going to make so many of these, and we're only going to make retail price on them, but then people are going to turn around and sell them for five or six times what we sell them for.
I know.
That makes no sense, other than the fact that they put people's lives in danger. And we haven't read it yet, but I'm sure in some newspaper we're going to read within days about some child that's been stabbed or killed
sure.
over these same shoes.
Sure.
So, you know, it just keeps going on and on and on, same, always. Well, it's interesting that while I was on hold, you brought up the coal mercury mess. I'm a tree-hugging liberal from a long time ago. I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s. And my dad was a professor in college, and one of the things he taught was ecology. And he had all sorts of cautionary tales about these kinds of things happening around this time that the early signs were showing, even back in the 70s and 80s, of the devastating nature of industry just run amok. And I think at this same time is when the filthy capitalists started realizing that, we better find some way to head them off at the pass or somebody's going to hold us responsible. And the refusal to take responsibility, which includes, hey, let's put out cleaner emissions, does make me feel like you do. I feel like they're just dirty pigs that all they're interested in is money. But what I cannot figure out for the life of me is that because it's what comes out of those tall stacks is so widespread all over the world. They're polluting the fish that they eat too.
That's the part I don't get either, Tim. You live in Decatur, Alabama. How long or how often do you get a chance to drive through even part of Appalachia? We have the Appalachian Mountains go right through north and northwestern Georgia, and we spend a lot of time up there. And I'll tell you, I realize some of this is natural, but this, you know, the Great Smoky Mountains have, in the Appalachian area, you can see the result of this. Have you seen the dying pine trees in your part of Alabama? Have you seen that?
That is not so much an issue right around here. Part of the foothills of the Appalachians are over in Huntsville, which is 20, 30 miles away.
Right.
But I grew up in East Alabama, and many times vacationed over in the Smokies and over in the North Georgia Mountains. I love it over there. I envy you for living there. But I have been up on top of Mount Mitchell, which is the highest point, of course, in the eastern U.S., and it's very obvious up there that something's killing the tree.
This has been going on for, when did this start? 15 years. Now, I realize some of this is a result of a beetle infestation that gets into these pine trees and they can't protect themselves. But the beetle, and I realize also that, I guess the beetle infestation, is a result of these creatures, they're not indigenous to the U.S., getting loose. But the fact is, global climate change and weather change and toxic air pollution weakens these trees to the point where they can't fight. They can't resist, whether it's a beetle or a virus that is specific only to these species of pine tree. But when you take all this stuff in combination, it's a losing situation. I mean, I think, and I know you think, and a lot of people think, why does this continue? If we can get a handle on at least part of it, you know, at least let's stop blowing the top off of mountains. Let's stop burning coal. Let's stop transmission lines that go halfway across the country. It's like Bruce just pointed out, so much of this power is lost because we don't generate power locally. I mean, this is crazy, Tim. Jesus.
Well, too, is that I don't think they take the advantage of, at least full advantage of things like up here. Of course, I live in the Tennessee Valley authority area.
Right.
And of course, I live not very far from a nuclear plant, but I live near some hydroelectric dams as well. I don't know what percentage of the time those are online, but it would seem to me that the Tennessee River, where it starts up around Knoxville, as you come down with the number of hydroelectric dams, that this area should be able to produce quite a bit of power. And, that should be true all around the country. Now, dams have their issues as well, but they can have benefits that they make big lakes, and that, in a way, with the reservoir behind the lake. Now, you've got water sometimes when it's dry. For example, here, where I live, I don't have to really worry that much about a drought as far as me having drinking water to use, because they take it out of the river and not refine it, but filter it and clean it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are ways that some things can add up to help. But you're right. The beetle problems and all these other things are, like you say, it's a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Something weakens the tree, something else weakens, and something else weakens, and it just gives the ability for those things to take hold and makes it very difficult to get rid of them.
That's right.
And it doesn't help that they plant the trees in plantations where once the beetles hit one end of the plantation, it's going to be through the whole plantation before you know it.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the diverse woods like we have here in North Alabama and on up in the Appalachians like you do, you don't have quite the pine tree plantations like you do in South Alabama where you can see miles and miles and miles of nothing but pine.
Well, we have that in south central Georgia, too. Just there are a lot of tree farms. And I can appreciate the idea of, you know, commercially grown trees to use for lumber instead of cutting down naturally grown or old growth forests. But because of this this infestation, because of different viruses that attack these trees, it just goes from one end to the other. I just wonder, Tim, sometimes, you know, a lot of folks who listen to this program, very few would admit it, though, are followers of the Christian faith. And it says all through the Christian faith and Judaism and Islam to be stewards of the earth. You know, in Genesis, where the God of Abraham says something to the effect that he's giving these people he just created dominion over everything. You know, here, take care of it. I give it to you. How do people of the book, Jew, Christian, or Muslim, how do they ignore the fact that they are not doing what their God told them to do? That's the part. And Tim, I have to leave it there. I appreciate what you had to say, pal. Check in again. I like hearing from you. But I just wonder how those people can blaspheme their own God. Aren't you Christians and Muslims and Jews who are involved in destroying the earth? Aren't you concerned about what's waiting for you when your God finally gets his hands around your neck? Are you kidding me?
Ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Let me get Bill in Paso Robles, California. He's been holding on for, well, since the program started. Hey, Bill.
yeah, Mike, that's about right. I'll cut right to the chase. You know, I could go on, but I'll cut right to the chase.
Okay.
I want your comments about Frances Fox Piven's conclusion in her interview, with one of your peers, you know, his initials are Tom Hartman.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he asked her, what is your final thought about this country, the future, the progressive future of this country and the Occupy movement? And she said, and these aren't her exact words, but I'm not more than, you know, half a word off. She said, if the Occupy movement fails, she has no hope for the United States, period. And you can take it from there, Mike. I'll just listen, unless you want to ask me something. I mean,
well,
that's what she said. It was that stark.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that conclusion at all. I think this country... The only disagreement I would have would be that it's only going to affect this country. I think the earth is really kind of, to borrow a phrase from Al Gore, the earth is hanging in the balance right now. And I think a lot of people are coming to this conclusion. They may be coming at it from different points of view.
Yeah.
Maybe their point of view is economic. Maybe it's environmental. Maybe it is spiritual. But I think a lot of people are coming across the country to the same realization, even though the scientific information is being suppressed as adroitly as possible, given the right wing control of media across the planet, given the right-wing control of government in this country. I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican, it's still right-wing. So I would agree with Ms. Piven that if the Occupy movement, which is nothing more or less than a consciousness raising movement, that's a reason to demand to talk to the leaders or demand to see a list of demands is asinine. That is not what Occupy is about. Occupy is occupying people's minds and saying, look, pay attention. If we have to get out here in tents and get gassed and beaten and killed, okay, but please pay attention. Raise your consciousness. Get away from butt-level consciousness and up to the level that we're all capable of. So I would agree that if the Occupy movement, which is a consciousness-raising movement, if it fails,
Can I ask you one final question,
sure.
Mike? And then I'll let you go.
Sure.
Do you think the occupation, the Occupy movement will ultimately fail?
No. I think what we're seeing, and I mentioned this a month ago, a couple of weeks ago, the Occupy movement now is in a transformative stage. The big encampments are not there. They're not visible. But there is organizing going on. I don't think the Occupy movement is going to fail. It may be forced to become something other than nonviolent resistance. But I don't think so. I think the core belief of the Occupy movement is nonviolence. Why fight violence with violence? Because you're going to lose if you do that. The militarized industrial state that is the U.S., that is Russia, that is China, that is just about any society you can think of, they're, the capitalist dominated, they're not going to tolerate that. If you want to get violent, they will come back with violence to the fifth power against people who are simply saying, raise your consciousness. Take a look at what we have done. Take a look at what the 1% continues to do. And for God's sake, or a Mother Earth's sake, or your baby's sake, or somebody's sake, bring it to a stop. So
I agree, Mike, and thanks a million.
Sure. All right. Appreciate it, Bill. Take care. But no, I completely agree with Francis Fox Piven, that if Occupy fails, and the objective of Occupy, and I don't speak for them, when I say it's a consciousness-raising movement, I'm not saying, I got an email from the head occupier. I try my damnedest not to get in the way of a movement that is of this sort, but my interpretation is that it is a movement designed to raise consciousness, to allow you, if you want to pull the scales off your eyes and see what's going on. The effort to stop blowing the tops off of mountains is the organization Coal River Mountain, CRM.org, that is trying to do that, is a consciousness raising organization. Peace movements are consciousness raising. Human rights movements, no matter what the human rights are, no matter what particular group it may affect, a change in laws may affect, it's all consciousness raising. Do you know what's not consciousness raising? Is when weapons are taken up and we decide to go kill somebody to get their oil, or kill somebody because our economic system, by God, is going to succeed and theirs is going to fail. That's consciousness destroying. 7 past the hour. This hour is sponsored by Gerard Brown. Thanks, Gerard. No message, just a sponsorship. Thank you. A couple emails here. One from Bob Kincaid at headonradionetwork.com. Mike, less than half of all electricity in the U.S. comes from coal. Of that, less than 5% is generated from mountaintop removal coal. It's utterly unnecessary for electrical generation, but mighty nice for profit generation. A recently released study shows that wind and solar are viable now, putting the lie to the unmitigated soulless propaganda that runs on networks like CNN, funded by the coal-fired bunch. We don't have to have these coal-borne diseases and birth defects. The only reason we still do is because it's a cheap, easy dollar that's made that way by our government's acquiescence and letting the industry continue to externalize the costs onto us. Don't give the Democrats a pass on the Bow and Scrape Act where coal is concerned. My congressman, Nick Joe Rahal, a long-tenured Democrat, has repeatedly bragged that he stopped outright a piece of legislation that would have brought mountaintop removal to a near end in the last Congress. The bill that would have done it had over 173 co-sponsors in the House. Incidentally, Rahal presides over one of the sickest districts in the entire nation. Coal does that. There really is a slow rolling genocide taking place right under folks' noses, Bob. Yeah, don't give the Democrats a pass on the Bow and Scrape Act where coal is concerned. No, I'm not giving the Democrats too much of a pass on anything. Bob Kincaid is the producer and host and originator of HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, and you can... Is Bob still on right after us, right? I think White Rose streams it live, or is it a repeat? Is it live? I know this. I don't know why I'm fumbling around here, but check out Bob Kincaid, because he's an activist, and he's right in the middle of this. In West Virginia, he's the kind of activist that gets out front of these issues and is willing to put himself on the line. And in coal country, that means putting your life on the line. So, what is it? Coal River Mountain, CRM.org. I think that's it, right? CRM.org. Check it out. And listen to Bob. Listen to his program. Regarding the dying trees, Bruce writes, "The biggest factor that kills the trees is monoculture. Most new trees in the U.S. are planted trees grown in nurseries to replant the massive tree farms like the operations owned by corporate people like the Koch brothers. As your caller pointed out, an infestation once started sweeps through these monoculture tree plantations. But the sheer size of that sort of biomass can then cut through the surrounding natural forests as well. The same apocalypse hangs over our food supply. You think people got nuts over basketball shoes? Wait for a time when rumors of food to eat carry the same weight." CRMW. I left off the W. CRMW.net or .org. CRMW.net. Yeah, .net. CRMW.net. So just add the W. I forgot it. CRMW.net. Please go to that website. Take a look around and see what you could do. You know, it's nothing serious. It's just your life depends on it. CRMW.net. Okay? Okay? I know you got a lot to do, but Come on. Don is in San Francisco listening still on Green 960. Not for much longer, Don, unless you want to stay up till 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Don.
I'm a disabled Asian American Vietnam vet who is liberal and is a paying subscriber.
Well, thank you.
And I want to say thank you to you and to Kathy for everything you do. It's important, and I appreciate it. And another thing, if I might, I'm looking at radiolineup.com, the lineup for Green 960. The general manager is a Dave P-U-G-H. It occurred to me that maybe my fellow listeners might want to drop a note to that fellow concerning the, shall we say, ill-advised pending changeover to radical neocon.
Well, Don, let me just say this. You know, there still is a modicum of free speech available. Mm-hmm. So if people want to send an email, they certainly may. But let me just tell you that it will do absolutely nothing.
I'm afraid you're right, but I thought it was worth a shot.
No, it really isn't. Just the harassment factor might be worth it, but it is the least effective means of letting a radio station know that or a program director or a general manager know that listeners are not satisfied with a change or with the programming, because the conglomerates, just remember, the guy whose name you said, he has zero power. He can do nothing. He's a little cog in a much bigger wheel. He's a worker bee. He makes no decisions whatsoever, not on programming, not on anything. It all comes,
okay. It all comes
from corporate headquarters. And when the Fairness Doctrine was ended under Reagan and the Consolidation Act was passed under Clinton, it guaranteed the absolute destruction of radio as a means of balanced conversation, information sharing, and so on and so forth. So this little guy over at the Green 960 has absolutely nothing to do with this decision. He doesn't make any decisions. So, and any emails you get will just automatically be deleted. So this is just the way it goes in capitalist corporate America. There actually was a time. I got into radio before the destruction of the Fairness Doctrine, before the implementation of the Consolidation Act. And back then, it wasn't that long ago, I'm talking 26 years ago, you had to present topics that and guests and subject matter that covered the spectrum of political talk, you being the station owners. If they did not, then when their license came up for renewal, if enough complaints were lodged, that license could be challenged and they ran the risk of losing it. But that's a joke now. The FCC, you can have 10,000 people challenge a license renewal, and the FCC just giggles and burps and renews the license. They don't give a damn. So I appreciate your sentiment. I thank you for your support. And I just must tell you, don't spend any time trying to stop Green 960 from doing what they're about to do. The guy who runs the station has no power. Zero. He has no power.
And then we have no recourse then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you do have recourse, and that's to do what you're doing. Be a podcast subscriber.
Yeah.
Listen via the internet. AM radio is, in so many areas of the country, is a dying proposition anyway. It's just a matter of time. Don, thank you. I appreciate your calling, and thanks for your support, pal. Take care. the hour. Chuck is in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, Mike. How you doing, guys?
I'm all right. How are you?
All right. I wanted to clarify the tree thing a little bit. Something.
Okay.
The trees on top of Mount Mitchell and the environs around there at the highest elevations are remnants from the last ice age.
Huh.
And there's spruce and fir, mainly fir, I believe. And the destruction that's been caused to them has been due largely to acid rain over the last 40, 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the acid rain issue has largely diminished, but not completely. So they're kind of in a state where they're not rebounding, but they're not getting any worse, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
The beetle issue, the only thing I know about as far as that goes is the hemlocks in Tennessee are dying rapidly. And there's a program in place by the Park Service there in the Smoky Mountains and around the park where they're planting disease variants that are disease resistant.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to get cross-pollination.
So there's an effort being made to stop this this deforestation by causes other than the timber industry, so to speak.
Right, right.
Well, good.
They're even giving out saplings and so forth to the public to plant. There's a on a separate issue. There's something I've been working on. I'm rather interested in. I've been thinking about the idea of using wind turbines along the interstates. It sounds kind of hokey at first until you think about it. If you have a megalopolis area like, say, D.C. to New York,
mm-hmm.
and you were to use an aggressive design that doesn't have to be aesthetically unpleasing, and when you consider that half or three-quarters of the energy in a gallon of gasoline is wasted to overcoming friction and wind resistance, and you consider how many gallons of gas are used, and diesel,
mm-hmm.
in the United States in a given year, there's a tremendous amount of potential there for energy savings as well as savings to the environment.
How would you place wind-driven turbines, the turbines that were close to the road? I think it's a hell of an idea, but how would you place them?
Well, actually, the most aggressive design is actually the most aesthetically pleasing. If you have a situation where in a corridor like that, if you took the safety lanes on the inside, if you have like a 10 or 20-foot area between them,
mm-hmm.
you could... you know how they have these safety walls now.
Right, right.
If you were to extend that on up, say, to 20 feet and mm-hmm. carry it over the safety zone, the shoulder, it now acts as a horn to collect that wind energy
mm-hmm.
on the inside and then divert it, have that wall actually be hollow, have two walls parallel going up.
Right.
And create a duct. And put the turbines inside that duct.
Well,
you now have a very concentrated form of energy that is used daily,
yeah.
especially during rush hour, which is the hours that are peak hours for usage. And the big advantage is that this is a source that is right directly at the load. In other words, your distribution center system is the system itself. You don't have to push it through 50 miles of wires to get mm-hmm. into the source of use.
Well, I don't know anything about your idea except what you just said, and what you just said sounds to me like just one hell of an innovative idea. It sounds like a good idea, and I think it makes a point, Chuck. I don't know how far this will go. I don't know if you'll draw up the design necessary, but what it proves to me is that there are ways to work our ways out of this mess if people who come up with stuff like this, like you, are listened to. There are ways to do this. Frances Fox Spivin in her interview with Tom Hartman apparently said that if the Occupy movement dies, so does this country. And, you know, while I can agree with that on a certain level, and I look at this stuff going on all around the planet, and it just scares the living hell out of me. But with all the doom and gloom, I think what you're showing, and I think a lot of people are showing, is that there are ways to avoid this catastrophe if people will just listen. And Chuck, I got to leave it there, but I'll tell you what, I'd like to hear more about this. Send me an email sometime, or I'll talk it up on the air again, or you call in again. Sounds like a pretty good idea to me. Thanks, Chuck. I appreciate it.
Life is funny. Skies are sunny. Bees make honey.
Before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Gerard Brown. Thank you, Gerard. I appreciate your sponsorship. Something I've been attempting to get up the nerve to do. Maybe tomorrow night. It's a poem by Ariel Dorfman. And it is Salvador Allende speaking to Barack Obama. But I think I'll wait on that. From Camille. Dear Mike, when I was in college protesting the Vietnam War, they wanted to shut down the university. Everyone was wearing black armbands. My friends and I decided to start a movement to wear white armbands. We wanted to declare that we were completely against the war, but also felt that stopping the education of young people was a major part of the reason we could have such an obscene war. We knew that those of us who were truly committed didn't need to shut down the university to be activists and have our voices heard. I say to all your listeners who feel betrayed that if they really want a more just system, they must participate constructively. They are not the majority any more than the Republicans are a majority. I believe we are in a major transition from a dominator paradigm to a partnership paradigm. This has been in motion for many, many years. As change has occurred, the dominators, oftentimes known as the patriarchy, are fighting back like a rat trapped in a corner, because regardless of appearances, they are in a corner. Look at how the Ohio vote or the recall efforts in Wisconsin are stronger than the money being used to crush these efforts. Look at how they're trying to destroy Elizabeth Warren, but so far her numbers continue to rise. The shadow is being revealed. This is not the time to subvert all potential for positive change. To me, voting a third party that can't win is the equivalent of giving up. We need to vote our first choices in primaries and then the Democratic candidate in 2012. We need to start locally, run for office as a Green or whatever group you want, or help someone else run for office, be it your school council, neighborhood council, city council, assembly person, etc. Make your voices heard on the grassroots level and change will ripple upward, but it will take time. Like Ralph Nader, do your critics really think he could have accomplished anything without senators and representatives willing to support him. The corporatization of power through greed, doublespeak, and fear did not happen overnight, and we can't expect it to change overnight. But things are changing, and if we hang in there, I believe the change will be for the better. Thank you for channeling my rage and holding to your point of view, Camille. It's Camille's point, of course. Her impassioned point was not to give up on the Democratic candidates at this point. Thanks for writing, Camille. The all right, I'm going to try this from Michael in Roswell. He wrote this a couple days before Christmas. We were talking about the Fukushima and the China Syndrome. And he says he'll try to answer that issue, however haltingly. This is what he writes. The best I can say about it is that we've had three really serious meltdown events in the last 30 years. Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. And none of them so far exhibited the behavior that the China Syndrome, the movie and the book, described. By my estimation, we'd be better off if these reactor failures had just dumped the fuel load into the center of the Earth, because the health effects of those accidents remaining close to the surface were actually worse than if those molten cores had headed straight down where they could do less harm. But to answer why so far there hasn't been a China Syndrome event in any of those disasters is that each, in some way, either did not produce enough heat to burn through the lower level of the outer containment. Three Mile Island resulted in only a partial meltdown, about 43% of the core. There's a strong likelihood a large amount of heat escaped the open roof of the Chernobyl containment after the hydrogen explosion, along with a huge load of fission byproducts. And in the case of Fukushima, a significant amount of heat was dissipated when the operators started flooding the containments with seawater. At least one reactor at Fukushima could still present even bigger problems than it has. The number three reactor running mixed plutonium oxide and uranium oxide fuel, but not because the molten fuel would go to the center of the Earth, but because it might still have the capacity to produce enough heat to burn through the containment and descend into the groundwater. That's the real danger, because the heat and radiation would be transferred to the drinking water. Steam would vent through cracks in the earth into the atmosphere, or because of the proximity of the site to the ocean, into the nearby seawater, and could create steam explosions that might further upset the surface geology around the reactor site. The problem with core meltdowns is that no one is certain how they behave in terms of decay or fission reactions. In a normally operating reactor, eventually some of the decay products absorb through neutrons to begin to reduce power production, which is the time when the operators arrange for a fuel replacement. With a melted core, those byproducts, depending upon temperature, can become alloys of the molten mass, or if the temperatures remain hot enough, the lighter fractions can float to the surface of the molten mass where they won't absorb any and where they won't absorb as many neutrons. With more plutonium in the fuel mix, there could be a lot more neutrons flying around to not only keep the reaction going at fast rates, but also to keep the temperature high. This has to do with the fact that even when the fuel is in normal operations, nearly expended, about 90% of the uranium component is still natural uranium. With enough neutrons flying around in an uncontrolled reaction, the natural uranium is converted to plutonium. With enough neutrons available, the natural uranium continues to be converted to fissionable material and additional heat. Thus far, the Fukushima operators have reduced the heat enough to prevent the molten core burning through the lower outer containment. But no one knows what might happen if the water pumped in can't reach enough of the molten core to significantly reduce the heat. The problem, to reiterate, is not the molten core heading to the center of the Earth, but that it descends deep enough to reach groundwater. Michael and Roswell, which is similar. Was it Prairie 2 who I don't know if he wrote something just specifically to me or if I read it on the air, one of his brief emails that said essentially the same thing, that it's not so much the meltdown itself, but what happens when it hits groundwater. So, I hope that made sense. By the way, this hour is being sponsored by Gerard Brown. Thank you, Gerard. What other good news events do we have for you tonight? Let me see. This is from Barry. Is it Barry? This also is about a week ago. Mike, I like to screw with the religious right's minds from time to time. But it's really easy since all you have to do is be logical. Here's something you might want to use. If President Obama wins re-election, the right wing and religious nuts will have to accept one of the following reasons that will be so hard to swallow. One, if they are so sure the president is a Muslim, then his winning re-election fairly proves that Allah and their God has stated they prefer Obama. So they should shut up. Or, if they believe Obama cheated and that he is a Muslim, then Allah is greater than the right-wing God since God couldn't prevent it. Or, if they accept that Obama is a Christian, then God wanted him to be president again. Or, if they believe that Satan is at work, then their God ain't so strong since he could whip Satan's ass, in theory. Or, their God is not at all pleased with the Republicans and the religious right and had Obama elected again to show them how to do it right. Or, God got in Obama's corner as a final call to the right wing that if they didn't get on the bandwagon, he'll fix it so that a woman will be president. Any way you look at it, it's becoming more apparent that God likes Obama more than he likes his right wing worshipers.
And don't let them smell those booze or use the cuss words like you like to use and think about taking the high road. Yeah, the high road, like you've always been shown. And think about what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? He'd get a haircut and a real job. There's nothing to prove to the world. There's nothing to rebel against when you get of it, Jim.
Before the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Gerard Brown. Thank you, Gerard. Very, very much. Yeah, I think I will try the Ariel Dorfman poem tomorrow. Hello, Mike. This is from Edward, who is confused in St. Louis. Hello, Mike. I'm writing to get your advice and opinion. I'm a 44-year-old white male who was born and raised in a left-leaning home, but was allowed to develop my own beliefs. Fortunately or unfortunately, however you look at it, I was introduced to Christianity as a preteen boy with all the typical right-wing conservative beliefs. From that point forward, I lived a typical right-wing lifestyle. I was in no way a Bible thumper, but I refused to entertain the idea that maybe, just maybe, the typical Christian conservative viewpoint was unrealistic and devoid of basic humanity. I refused to entertain that idea. It wasn't until September 11, 2001 that I was forced to view life without the typical conservative blinders. Up until then, I was so wrapped up in my job and career that I simply did not pay attention to the rest of the world. After those terrible events of 9/11, I began to see the world with a far more open-minded viewpoint. I have since shed nearly all typical conservative beliefs and embrace a much more basic and realistic view of myself, my country, and my fellow man. I now work hard to live my life by the golden rule. I no longer claim to know all the answers to how this country should be run just because I am a Christian male. I now find myself completely abandoned by my conservative family and treated as if I have been seduced by the dark side. My priest even went so far as to pull me aside and tell me I am jeopardizing my eternal life with my liberal leanings, and may want to stay away from attending Mass until I, quote, find my way back to Jesus and his church, end quote. Whew. My question is this. Is it so important to be a member of a particular political party? I have been a lifelong member of the Republican Party. However, I'm about a half step from leaving. I'm sick and tired of the double standards of the right and find myself wanting. I want to feel as if I belong to a political party that is for all people, not just those who believe the same as me. In an attempt to learn more about what it means to be liberal, I began to immerse myself in left media. I eventually found my way to the Mike Malloy Show and other left shows on my Sirius Radio. For about 3 years now, I've listened to your show and others from the left, and I'm now convinced it is time to listen to my sense of right and wrong and make a choice. The problem is, I'm not sure if I should leave the Republican Party and join the Democratic Party or try to change the Republican Party from within. Is there a home in the Democratic Party for a white Christian male who still has a couple of conservative views but now embraces many liberal beliefs? Any advice would be greatly appreciated. Thanks, Edward, confused in St. Louis, Missouri. Now, I would strongly recommend you don't join any party. Dissolve your membership in the Republican Party because that's a party of death. Stay away from the Democratic Party because, in my opinion, the Democratic Party is a corporatized entity that really does not exercise the power that it might have if it were to get rid of its corporate owners. So just be independent. I mean, the fact that you have come to understand that some of the conservative views that were force-fed into you were force-fed for a reason that had nothing to do with you or your life, but had to do with control. And the proof of that, of course, is the fact that your family or your friends or whatever have now abandoned you, and your priest is warning you that your immortal soul will burn in hell for all eternity if you don't get your ass back in the church and stop thinking for yourself. You know, they said the same thing to the Catholic Church has been saying the same thing to independent thinkers for millennia. So you ought to say to your priest that, you know, wherever... Oh, never mind. You can figure that out yourself. But no, don't join the Democratic Party. And as far as the Republican Party is concerned, you have an ice cube's chance in hell of reforming the Republican Party, or for that matter, the Democratic Party. All I can suggest at this point is pay very close attention to what candidates for political office are saying. Check their background, and when you find the lies, don't vote for them. Or listen very carefully to what political candidates are saying, and when you check the background or their previous voting record and find out that they are not telling the lies and that their beliefs are parallel to yours, then I guess vote for them, which is no guarantee at all that your vote will be registered or counted or have any difference in the outcome whatsoever. Rather, Edward, confused in St. Louis, Missouri, give up the whole thing and just, I don't know, start buying canned goods. Continue to listen to this program if you want. Focused on things that really count, like not how you live your political life, but how you live your mental or internal or spiritual life. Crappy advice, huh? Edward, you're probably still confused in St. Louis. I'm confused in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountain. Trust me. See you tomorrow night, True Seekers. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.